Welcome to Coastal Connection. I'm Brian Russo. We're looking back on some of our favorite musical performances and conversations with songwriters both on the rise and at the top of their game. Coming up later in the show, we'll hear in-studio performances from indie rockers Cliff Hillis and Amy Correa, and we'll find out how the members of the Preservation Hall Jazz Band are preserving a culture by exposing kids to the sound of New Orleans. But first, we'll start with our conversation with world-renowned songwriter Billy Bragg. Bragg is a passionate and powerful singer-songwriter who brings the edge of punk rock sensibility to the world of folk music. He's played all over the world in the past 3 decades and has received critical acclaim for his unique brand of storytelling and songwriting. He's also widely known for his political activism in the UK. Back in July, we spoke to Bragg during his tour to celebrate the year that would have been the late great songwriter Woody Guthrie's 100th birthday. Bragg was joined by American roots rockers Wilco to put out 2 Grammy-nominated albums called Mermaid Avenue Volumes 1 and 2. They were comprised of songs they built around some of Woody Guthrie's lost lyrics. The 2 albums were re-released recently and accompanied by a making-of documentary to create Mermaid Avenue: The Complete Sessions. We'll start by listening to one of the tracks off the first volume of Mermaid Avenue. This is California Stars. Billy Bragg joins me now on the phone from Wisconsin. Mr. Bragg, welcome to Coastal Connection, and thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure, Brian. Good to be speaking to you.
So every time I listen to the Mermaid Avenue records, I just keep thinking back to the first time I read about how the project started, which is now kind of a famous story, but in a nutshell for those listening, Woody Guthrie's daughter, Nora, asked you to take his songwriting notebooks and put music to these lost lyrics of sorts. So I guess now, tell me what it means to you as a songwriter to be able to play these songs that you essentially kind of helped bring to life sonically in a sort of dreamlike collaboration with one of your songwriting heroes.
Well, yeah, there were lyrics that did have music, but Woody didn't write musical notation, so he kept the tunes in his head. And when he died in 1967, those tunes were lost forever. So Nora was kind of presenting me with an opportunity to, if you like, collaborate with the father of the sort of tropical song tradition of which I feel a part, you know. So I'll be honest with you, I really thought initially it was probably Bob Dylan's job and not my job, but she convinced me that she needed someone who wasn't overly familiar with Woody because she wanted someone to make a record that challenged the idea of Woody Guthrie rather than just carried on the same old, same old. I think she felt he'd been a bit in the 1980s, he'd been a bit hijacked by academics. So she encouraged us to record songs about his love for Ingrid Bergman, about hitching a ride on a flying saucer. And I think the opening track, Walt Whitman's Niece, about him and a couple of sailors chasing women in Brooklyn in the 1940s.
Right. I want to play a snippet of one of my favorite songs off the records. This is She Came Along to Me.
But never, 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 never could have it been done if the women hadn't entered in. Like she came along to me.
Tell me a little bit about the first time that you saw the lyrics to this song and how maybe they inspired you to create what we now hear as the musical bed for this song.
Well, She Came Along to Me was written in 1942, and I think it's, looking into it, it's both a love song to Nora's mum, Woody's wife, Marjorie, but also it's an attempt to recognize the role of women in society, their own a contribution, particularly to the war effort at the time. And I think this puts Woody out as a real early sort of proto-feminist, because he recognizes in a way that very few songwriters did back then the important role that women have always played, both in society in general, but particularly in time of struggle. So it leapt out to me. And I think Nora had, or someone had written on the manuscript, a song about mum. So I thought, you know, it's the least I could do for Nora is to record it. But, you know, it's a song that could have been written any time in the last 60, 70 years.
Well, you know, it's interesting because people have looked at your career and noted how almost courageous you are at bringing out very tricky and controversial subject matter and putting them into, you know, kind of the sonic formula of what we know as a 3 or 4 minute song.
talk about, you know, just how far ahead he was at doing, you know, just that, bringing up very, you know, tricky subject matter that's very, you know, layered and complex.
Yeah, I think but basically most people are familiar with Woody's work are thinking about songs that he wrote in the 1930s and recorded in the very early 1940s. Many of the Mermaid Avenue songs were written in the late 40s in Brooklyn, in New York, in Coney Island, where he lived with his family and Nora. And they reflect a much more modern world. I mean, one of the songs that we recorded for the sessions is called My Flying Saucer, in which he tries to hitch a ride on a flying saucer to fly him back home. Mm. And he wrote, in that particular notebook, he wrote tempos for the songs. And the tempo he wrote for My Flying Saucer was supersonic boogie. Hmm. And when you find a Woody Guthrie who's writing a supersonic boogie song, then, you know, you really can use any music that, you know, has existed in the last 60 years to use as a backdrop. I said to Jeff Tweedy when I showed him that lyric, look, this is our get out of jail free card. You know, if anyone says to us, are you sure Woody would have done it this way?
Right.
We can show him the supersonic boogie tempo and say, look, he was thinking about that. I mean, there was some suggestion of Woody wanting an electric guitar in the early 50s, although he was in hospital and incapacitated. He did ask his son if he could get him a Les Paul. So, you know, it could have been Woody Guthrie that broke Pete Seeger's heart in Newport, right, rather than Bob Dylan in the 60s. Woody might have done that in the 50s. I mean, how great would that have been? An electric Woody Guthrie would have really been a proto-punk, because he also said, anybody who knows more than two chords is showing off.
Well, how much of that, when you were creating these records with, you know, with the gentleman from Wilco, how much of that, you know, kind of spirit of Woody Guthrie was in the room, where, you know, you wanted to create these sonic landscapes for his lost lyrics of sorts? I guess, did that inhibit the creative process? I mean, were you plagued with, well, Woody wouldn't have done it this way?
What we used as a kind of a sort of like a model was the basement tapes, which were recorded by Bob Dylan and the band. Right. If you listen to the actual basement tapes, the complete sessions, they've written songs, but they're also playing loads of old-timey songs from the American 19th century, right, and early 20th century. But they're playing them in the knowledge, you can hear by the way they play them, that they have heard Little Richard and Chuck Berry, mm-hmm, and Otis Redding. And what they're doing is they're using the music they know to interpret the songs. And that's what we did. We felt that we should see Woody against the backdrop of American music of the 20th century. We were recording in the very late 1990s. And so, you know, really we thought we could use any music that we'd heard and bring that to bear on it. And that was the sonic landscapes that we created, which I think I would really like to say were mostly down to Jay Bennett, who at the time was in Wilco. Jay's sadly, mm-hmm, no longer with us. But he is responsible for the fabulous sound of Mermaid Avenue. And, you know, he's a guy who could play any instrument, Jay. And he did a really great job in not only making Mermaid Avenue sound eclectic, but also at the same time making it sound cohesive.
What's the reaction been on this current tour from American audience, and you know, whether they be, you know, a younger generation that's just learning, you know, what a phenomenal, you know, songwriter Woody Guthrie was, or, you know, the older generations that really, you know, bring this music back to life and make them fall in love with Woody Guthrie all over again?
Well, my job, if you've read this, I don't know if you've read Nora Guthrie's sleeve notes on the recently released complete Mermaid Avenue sessions, but she talks about us forcing people to rethink who Woody Guthrie is. So I challenge people's perception about Woody. I think he's not right. It's not right to see him as an icon, because if anything, he was an iconoclast. So I make some iconoclastic points. I mean, the current show I'm doing, the first half, the first hour, is me playing songs from Mermaid Avenue acoustically and talking about different aspects of Woody's life that perhaps won't be familiar to fans. And in the second half, there's a 15-minute break, and then the second half I come out and talk about Billy Bragg songs and play Billy Bragg stuff until the end of the evening. And it's worked really, really well. Yeah, it's a good mixture. It sort of flows together. And by the time I get to Easter, I'll have been down in Okemo, Woody's home, and I'll have been in Coney Island with Nora on his 100th birthday. So I'm sure I'll be supercharged when it comes to summoning up the chap that we euphemistically refer to as the little guy.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about your work again, because, you know, I mentioned earlier that, you know, you're in addition to being an amazing songwriter that's never afraid to take on big issues with your songs, you're also a very accomplished political activist. What role do you think songwriters have in kind of sparking a narrative in what's happening in our world, whether it be protesting or just, you know, providing some sort of insight to complex subjects?
That's it. You got it right there, Brian. All they can do is offer a different perspective. It's ultimately down to the audience to change the world. It always has been. They have the responsibility and my continued faith in them to do that is justified in places like Madison, Wisconsin, where the recall campaign against Governor Walker, although that's ended now and they didn't get their recall, the people are still outside the Capitol building every lunchtime singing the old songs. I was out there with them today. And it's interesting, you know, I'm playing the Barrymore Theatre. I'll be playing the Avalon when I come to Easton. Woody Guthrie never played places like the Avalon. Mm-hmm. The kind of places Woody played, he played where I was today on the steps of the Capitol, the radical songs, the old-time religion with those people. So, you know, I'm closest to what Woody was doing when I'm out there on the steps of the Capitol with the people protesting against those who would take pension rights, take decent, affordable housing and free education and proper health care. You know, and when we're defending those things, I'm closest to doing Woody's work.
Mermaid Avenue, the complete sessions, is at record stores everywhere. We're going to take you out here with Way Over Yonder in the minor key. Billy Bragg, it was a pleasure to chat with you, and best of luck, and thank you so much for being here on Coastal Connection.
Thank you, Brian. Nice to speak to you, mate.
I lived in a place called Ofuski, and I had a little girl in a holler tree. I said, little girl, it's plain to see, ain't nobody that can sing like me, ain't nobody that can sing like me. She said, it's hard for me to see how one little boy got so ugly. Yes, my little girlie, that might be, but there ain't nobody that can sing like me. Ain't nobody that can sing like me. Way over yonder in the minor key. Way over yonder in the minor key.